Okay, let's do some quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on multiple systems, on delivering your product or service, the more margin you have and the more money you keep. That's obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. To reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. Here's the thing. Information is power. Information is money. Literally, the currency of today's world of entrepreneurship is information. And if you could bring all of the information about your business into one dashboard, this is incredibly valuable. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, HR into one platform and one source of the truth about your business. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required, access from anywhere. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified business management suite. And you're improving efficiency by bringing all of your major business processes into one platform, slashing manual tasks and errors. This is so valuable. You just hit a button and you can see all the information about your business instead of having to like call five different departments and get all these emails and put it all together and make sense of it. Over 37,000 companies have already made the move. So do the math, see how you'll profit with NetSuite. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/James. netsuite.com/James. netsuite.com/James.
This isn't your average business podcast, and he's not your average host. This is the James Altucher Show. Today on the James Altucher Show.
So this starts to get into the crux of the matter of AI, which is obviously AI is this huge boon to society. In many ways, it helps people. It increases corporate profits, which in turn help people further. But there's kind of a dark side to it. So if we're starting to replace the people who are delivering the food by auto-driving cars, if we're starting to replace the teachers, the artists, the workers who shelve factories, so everybody from blue collar to white collar, you know, the bank lending officers and so on, the fear is billions of jobs will be lost around the world.
I think people, you know, I think there is unbelievable attraction and addiction to hard work, because hard work comes out with rewards.
And meaning, as you mentioned earlier.
And meaning, yes. Rewards in terms of financial fame, sense of accomplishment and actualization. This can become addictive. And that's what I fell into. And I think the societal values rewards that. People admire you if you work hard, or and certainly rewards you when you're successful. But when I was faced with the possibility that I had only a month to live, it suddenly realized to me none of this really meant anything. That the only things that were meaningful to me was spending time with the people I loved and doing things that I loved. And then I realized how foolishly that I had lived, and I vowed to change my ways if I could get better. And I did. So I now work maybe 20% less. And it was that awakening and epiphany that when I saw AI might take a lot of routine jobs away, I think actually for the very long term, it's good for humanity, because we continue to fall into this trap of downward spiral of continuing to be addicted to work and seemingly prove that we're worth something. But in fact, when we pass on and die, we won't be remembered. So it's really a matter of giving back to the people who love you.
I've got one of my favorite human beings in the world, Kai-Fu Lee, here. First off, by intro, he wrote a great new book. I mean, this is a book that
everybody in America should read. I'm sure everyone in China is going to read it, but it's called AI Superpowers, China, Silicon Valley, and the New World Order. And it deals with such interesting questions like what really is AI, how it's going to change the world, how we could potentially react to it in terms of, you know, will it cause lost jobs? Who are going to be the winners in terms of, you know, the different countries and companies involved? And also it has some very personal stories in there as well, which we'll get to. But first, I also want to say, Kai-Fu Lee, you were running Apple's speech recognition back in the early 90s. You're probably the reason now there is a Siri and Alexa and so on. I don't know if you take credit for that ever, but that was the work you did when I knew you 25 years ago. Then you helped run Microsoft China, then Google China, then you started your own investment firm, Synovation. You've got 50 million followers on China's social media. You've been neck deep in all the innovations and the growth of capitalism and innovation in China. And now you're back here to tell that. But one more thing before I let you talk. You had two or three influences on my life. One is you were involved in convincing me to go to graduate school at Carnegie Mellon when you showed me the speech recognition work you were doing, which your software had to recognize commands that were on a Navy battleship. That was the state of speech recognition at the time.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And then at the end of my graduate school career, I went to you with one last chance of something I might be interested in. I wanted to work on, you had made the world champion Othello program, and I wanted to make a program to work on the game Go, and you said it wasn't possible. So you said no to me, but you were right, because it wasn't until 2017 that Google, using the AI company DeepMind, made AlphaGo, which beat the world champion of Go. And your work on your Othello program really influenced how I thought about AI, and you know how it wasn't, you know, as portrayed in the movies where, oh, somebody's just going to wake up and be like Scarlett Johansson in Ex Machina. AI is really about understanding data and statistics and neural networks in such a way that it could ideally make our lives better. I don't know if you have a different definition of AI.
Oh, no. Hi, it's great to see you again, James. It's been a long time.
Yeah, it's been since 1991, I think.
That's right. Although we follow each other on the internet, and
yes.
I hear you tell my stories from time to time.
I've written about you a couple of times.
Yes, no, that's great. No, I think your understanding of AI is the AI of today. We call it artificial narrow intelligence, in the sense that it works in a narrow domain with one objective function, and with huge amounts of data, it generalizes incredibly well and beats humans regularly. But then it's not the artificial general intelligence, or AGI, which is human equivalent in terms of, in addition to a narrow function, AGI would also be equivalent to people in terms of common sense reasoning, multi-domain reasoning, planning, strategic thinking, creativity, self-awareness, maybe even emotions.
Of different things. Like, for instance, creativity, AI could potentially understand data from the brain. Oh, what music makes people feel happy? What makes them feel sad? What do they enjoy? And then AI could potentially use that data without being necessarily creative. AI can use that data to create music or art, for instance.
Yes, as long as there's an objective feedback. So if there is a clear tagging for I'm happy, I'm not happy, I like it, I don't like it, it's the stock went up, the stock went down, the person paid back the loan, the person didn't pay back the loan. As long as there's an objective label or tagging, AI can learn the skill.
So let's take pay back the loan, didn't pay back the loan.
Okay.
So the way I think of AI now is you have lots of, let's say a new person comes in, wants a loan. There's a lot of data about this person, whether it's a man or a woman, what state they're from, what's their job, what's their income, what's their prior payment history, what kind of house do they own, what kind of car do they own. Maybe there's other data. Maybe there's Facebook-related data. What bands they like, what books they like, who knows? There's a lot of data about the person. And if an AI program examines data from millions and millions of people who have been labeled payback loan, didn't payback loan, and you have all the same data about each one of those person, or each one of those people, potentially AI can now label the new person likely to pay back loan, not likely to pay back loan.
That's exactly right. And the amazing thing about AI is it can take, you describe what we humans think of as the top 7 or 8 attributes about paying back loan, but AI can go to thousands or tens of thousands of attributes. For example, we, as a VC, we funded a company called Smart Finance, and they built an app, and you basically apply for your loan. In addition to filling out those 7 or 8 pieces of information, you also push a button to have it take information from your phone that is at the same level that Facebook, YouTube, and others take. And with that data, it can look into what apps you have installed, what's in your contacts, whether the contacts numbers are legitimate, and whether you have a lot of gaming apps, what kind of phone you use, how often you use your phone, as well as what day of the month it is, which relates to your payday potentially, and as well as things like that seem like they should be irrelevant, but are all contributing to a small extent, like your battery level. So 3,000 features were taken, actually more than 3,000 features were taken, and the AI learned that there were 3,000 degrees of correlation. So for example, battery level is one of the least useful, but still barely useful features.
But if you're always at a low battery level, if you always let things go to the edge.
Yes.
You know, but here I'm trying to rationalize it. My rationalization is not important. Mm-hmm. The AI just determines statistically this conjoined with these other 2,999 features lead to a decision. My rationalization is just my human way of putting into it.
That's right. It just means for the last 10 million people who did pay back the loan and the 1 million people who didn't pay back, battery level was more correlated with those who had more battery was more correlated with the group paying back. Those who had almost no battery was more correlated with those who didn't pay back.
Could people game the system? Like, in the sense, could I have two phones and like I keep all my games on my other phone, I keep this battery level high, and I'm going to give you this phone? Like, if people understand, they can game the system a little.
Of course you can. That's why I'm telling you one of the least important features, battery level, because that would not tip the scale, you know, 99.9999% of the case. So it doesn't really help. I'm purposefully giving a feature that's barely relevant, but still relevant.
It's interesting because I don't want to get too weeds onto this one thing, but this does remind me, of course, we just discussed you had built the world champion Othello program and you used a set of features and you labeled each game won or lost and you had the program play itself over and over again, and that's how you created this world-class software. What's different now? There's obviously a lot more features, but also is the AI discovering what features are important?
Yes, it is. So back in the days I was in grad school, the features were largely selected by experts, and then the AI could combine them. Because at that time, we could combine maybe 4 or 5 or 6 features. Otherwise, the matrix multiplication gets too cumbersome, right? So 5 by 5 matrix multiplication, that was manageable. But nowadays, it's 3,000 by 3,000. They could be done by GPU. So the big difference is there can be a lot more features. So basically, you just throw everything in, and you might as well throw in the ones that are raw without human processing.
How does the AI avoid what's called curve fitting, where it thinks there's a statistical correlation, but there isn't?
Well, by having enough data and by tying the various parameters together so that it's trainable. So it's always a ratio of how much training data you have versus how many connections you have in your deep neural network.
So if you have enough data, it might be on the first 1,000 cases, oh, it looks like this feature is important, but then you look on the next 1,000 cases, it's probably constantly testing whether a feature is as important as it thought.
That's right. And it can choose to make the matrix very sparse. If 3,000 features you feed in, there are only 100 useful ones. The rest will be a sparse matrix, which will barely make a difference in the final outcome.
And again, the model for this, I mean, you use the term neural network, but it really strikes me as mostly statistics. And the reason I say that, the reason I don't like the word neural network so much, and you could disagree, is there's this whole branch of, let's call it science fiction AI, where the computers are suddenly going to wake up. And that's not really what we're talking about here. We're talking about using data to understand humans and life and systems in a way that computers weren't able to previously.
Yeah, I think that's fair to say. Most people who use neural network are the word artificial neural network, indicating it's not the same as our brain working. There are some inspirations based on today's AI design that there are artificial connections, which are trained by weights, and that's by no means equivalent to the way our brains work, but it was inspired by the architecture of our brain.
And I always thought there was, particularly in the early 90s, I always thought there was a little aspect of neural networks that they called it neural just because it was easier to get government funding that way by saying, hey, we're going to wake up, we're going to have a new brain here.
Could be.
So you talk about, there's three reasons why this book is such a must read. Maybe four reasons. You really define what AI is and the different types of AI and where it's heading. And where it's heading is just amazing. And this is not in the long-term future, but even in the short-term future. You also discuss, and this was kind of oddly inspirational to me, capitalism in China is cutthroat. It's brutal. Yes. Like, it really struck me as much more capitalist than the U.S. I mean, these people go at each other and in very innovative business model ways that aren't restricted, that have no restrictions on them.
Yeah, it's a winner-take-all environment. It's not clear what exactly caused that. I think maybe a lot of Chinese entrepreneurs have been poor for 10 or 20 generations. So the desire to really make it was incredibly important. And I think the origins of the Chinese entrepreneurship was copycat, right? Copying the U.S. ideas. And once people all learned by copycat, they feel they need to, in order to win, they not only have to win, everyone else has to lose. Otherwise, there's always going to be a copycat who raises $100 million and copies your technology and price competes with you. So if you want to be the only winner left standing, then you have to come up with some business model that is uncopyable, that's so impregnable.
You spoke about the example of the copycat version of Groupon in China. So first off, Groupon tried to team up with Tencent, the one of the biggest internet companies in China, or maybe the biggest, and they lost because the copycat version of Groupon dominated. Maybe you could talk about that as an example.
Sure. I think Groupon plus Tencent at the time just had too little ambition. It was going to replicate whatever it did in the U.S. And by that time, China had already significantly advanced so that at least one of the 5,000 copycats of Groupon.
There were 5,000 copycats.
That's right. And only one survived to date. The other 4,999 all died, exactly as the gladiator analogy I made. It was like a coliseum with 5,000 people entering. They battle each other. Only one survived. And the survivor, of course, came up with an impregnable business model, which was that they were going to change the way Chinese people eat by delivering the food not only within 30 minutes while it's still hot, including the cooking time, but also make it so cheap to deliver at 70 cents per delivery. And that's done with a lot of wonderful AI, but also a lot of unbelievable operational excellence.
And I have to say almost a trickle-down effect from the government mandate that, hey, these businesses need to be funded. So, I mean, ultimately, to lose money for a while so you can gain market dominance, you need to be well-funded. You need some sort of venture capital welfare to lose money for a while.
Well, yes, if you look at all the money that's poured in to these 5,000 Groupons, it's probably $10 or $15 billion. In the end, the company Meituan is worth $55 billion.
Right.
So it was worth it. The overall VC got a decent return, maybe 3x return. But if you weren't in Meituan, you lost it all. If you were in Meituan, you made maybe 100x.
But what was interesting is that In America, it seems there's this emphasis on focus. Like, if you're going to be Groupon, be Groupon. If you're going to be Uber, just be the platform where you know, the drivers join to the platform and the riders join to the platform. Don't be anything else. If you're going to be Airbnb, just be the platform where, you know, empty houses can sign up and people who need empty houses can sign up. But it seems like and focus is rewarded in the United States, but in China, it doesn't have the same restriction. Like your example with the ride sharing company, Didi, they not only have the platform for the drivers and the riders, but they also own the gas stations and the auto mechanic shops. That would never happen in the U.S.
That's right. They also have joint ventures in insurance, car leasing. They want to control the whole chain. If you think about the weakness of Uber today, it's because Lyft could more or less compete with them in selected cities, because as long as you can get a car in 3 minutes, you might as well download two apps. Yeah. And each driver might as well be drivers on the two platforms. So the way Didi avoids that is they own the entire chain. And if you're a Didi driver, you enjoy the benefits of lower cost insurance, leasing, gas, and repair. And the moment you take a competitor on as a second driver, you will be kicked out of the Didi ecosystem.
So the reason I think that the U.S. and China are different in that specific way is that Uber can argue, because the purity of its business model, that they deserve, you know, 1,000 times profits valuation. And Wall Street rewards that. Wall Street, you know, auto mechanic shops are valued at 5 times earnings. Yeah. Technology companies are valued at 1,000 times earnings. And if you mix the two, you have to figure out, valuation becomes complicated. It doesn't seem the same issue happens in China. I don't know why.
Well, it's just math, right? I mean, if Wall Street ought to be sophisticated enough to take a conglomerate that has 5 businesses and apply appropriate multiples and do a hybrid, it would seem.
Right.
But back to Meituan, you know, delivering the food 30 minutes to every home at 70 cents, that required hiring 600,000 people at minimum wage, and also suffer the turnover and the training that's required, because these are not people who could get a job on the factory floor at the Foxconn. So they're willing to make less. And yet you have to attract them, train them, make sure they're courteous, and also have a rating system. So if they're not, they're fired. And then they will turn over, because once they learn all the manners from you, they can get a better job. So you have to manage that cost. Then you have to figure out how to deliver. You know, Uber Eats is not the answer. The answer is electrical mopeds charged on batteries. Then you have to deal with changing of batteries. So it's an incredibly cumbersome, hairy problem to solve.
And is the AI involved in the logistics? Like,
yes.
Who do you deliver to first, fastest, and so on?
Right. So it's a more fancier version of Uber, because you've got restaurants to pick up orders, people to deliver them to, and then your battery, which runs out and needs to get changed, and all that in a system, plus the equivalent of surge pricing. Because once you don't have enough people picking up, you won't meet your 30-minute deadline. Then you got to give people incentives to wake up and do the delivery. So it's very, very complex.
And how do you deal with, I mean, it must be like management principles in China must be different from here too, because if you have 600,000 employees plus your normal business that you're supporting, the management issues must be complicated to keep people motivated, to keep people with a certain vision, knowing that some part of your working class is going to quit every 3 months, and others that you want to stay for life, and so
sure.
on.
Well, it's a clearly two-class citizen kind of an environment, in which I think of them as, you know, think of them as Uber, right? Mm-hmm. The Uber drivers versus the Uber AI programmers. I think that's not too dissimilar. But the thing is, if you're willing to take that hairy a problem, once you solve it, you could be worth $55 billion like Meituan, versus Groupon, only a few billion. And on top of that, you have such a high barrier of entry that a competitor would have to spend easily $5 billion, if not more, plus hire 600,000 people, plus do all the things you've done, plus probably lose money for a long time. And if they never get down to the operational excellence, down to 70 cents a delivery, then even if you get to $1.70, at 25 million orders a day, you're losing $25 million a day. So that's the stakes and the risks that you'd be taking in such a competition in China.
And then, you know, you also described the so-called copycat Airbnb, but what's different from Airbnb here is they, in many cases, own the homes.
Right. Well, if you look at buying a giant building that might be constructed in a modular fashion and it's consistently managed, the cost goes way down. And also, if you look at the Chinese traveler, they're not so much traveling for leisure. They're more traveling for the kid's school or for someone's ill and you're a son or daughter who needs to basically live near a hospital to accompany your parents as they travel to another city where there are better hospitals. The entire dynamics are different.
But this inspires me about capitalism. It, oddly, reading about China inspires me about capitalism and entrepreneurship here. Right. You would think someone from maybe Airbnb would read this and say, oh, you know, it's not a bad idea to own buildings near hospitals or, you know, because that's obviously an issue here too. Or I don't know. It's just, it was so fascinating. And to see how cutthroat too, between the different chatting companies, how they would try to destroy each other.
Yeah.
And here that's largely restricted and regulated. But there it's like, everybody's going for the throat. They're killing each other.
Well, there's only one winner at the end in each Colosseum. And even when you become the winner, you upgrade to the next Colosseum. It's like a video game. So Meituan, after winning the food delivery, moved on to movie tickets and travel. And before you know it, they'll be fighting it out with Alibaba.
And the same thing, I thought it was fascinating. WeChat has become this sort of mobile app of apps. Like it becomes a platform for building apps, which is, I guess, similar to the iTunes store, but not quite. Like that, the app platform is more hardware and API related. This is more the functionality is built within WeChat to make apps.
Yeah. So WeChat, think of it as Swiss Army knife that has within it WhatsApp and Facebook. But on top of that, it's a one-button access to pretty much everything you ever want to do. Think of it as having an Amazon embedded, as having a Grubhub embedded, as having Uber and Airbnb, all one button away and also connected with payment.
And so what's fascinating about that is you have these companies doing, and this is related to the AI and your point in the book about China potentially getting ahead of the U.S. in AI and how important that is. When you have one app or one program or one company that has access to so many different types of data, and we're talking about 100 times Facebook times data, and already data with Facebook, you know, they're appearing in front of the Senate, it's such an issue. When you have that data, you're going to know everything about the person, and then all of these factors and variables to figure out what my next decision is. I mean, the software will know before I do what packages I should be receiving yesterday. You know, and it will deliver it yesterday.
Well, the software will know better than you do what you want to eat tonight, what vacation you want to take, at some point, who you want to date.
Yeah, I mean, I imagine, like, if you were to say, what's the AI outcome that you're most looking forward to in the next few years, what would it be?
Well, looking forward, that would be healthcare and education, because that's universally good for humanity. And we're actually just beginning a lot of investments in these areas. But honestly speaking, most of our existing investments are in things that are more like face recognition and finance and semiconductors and autonomous driving. Those are where the money is. But the ones I'm really looking forward to are healthcare and education.
So let's take face recognition as an example. So this was the thing that 30 years ago AI wasn't able to do, but now AI can very successfully do it. If I see someone, let's say, robbing a deli 50 yards away, right now in America, if I wanted to recognize who this person is so I can track them down, I would have to take a picture, but then do some sort of deal with Facebook, which has the largest collection of faces, and hope that they would tell me who this is. And maybe they might get it, maybe they wouldn't. Is there a in China right now, or is the AI moving towards a better solution?
Well, I think in China or the US, if you have a proper camera installed in most convenience stores or banks, that would, if that's high enough resolution and that's connected to the police database of criminals, at least you can match that robber with the criminal database and see if matches are triggered.
But in China, if I'm connected to WeChat instead of the police database of criminals, I maybe can find the criminal that much faster. I'll have more photos and more people that I have access to photos of.
Yeah, I don't think WeChat would allow that because you have only access to the people you know. So it's like Facebook, right? It has an upper bound of 5,000 friends.
Right.
So you could find out if one of your 5,000 friends committed the robbery, but that's not too useful.
So although it might be in my case, I don't know. In education, you know, you mentioned how it's, you know, we've since the 19th century, a lot of our educational system is, you know, this factory style force feeding of facts, and it's kind of a one size fit all, no matter what the child might be talented at or interested in. How do you think AI can change education?
Well, I think the teacher does a lot of routine tasks that we don't usually think about. For example, giving homework assignments, grading them, giving tests, grading them, doing the drills, correcting pronunciation, correcting grammar, doing the simple math drills, and of course the lecture may not be best given by each individual teacher, but maybe there are great teachers who could give it. So the combination of AI doing all these tasks plus MOOC, I think, can really make AI much more education much more scalable, because AI can do a better job than the teacher on, let's say, half the tasks, freeing the teacher to become more of a mentor. So that is the vision that we have in China, because China has schools with highly variable capability teachers, like villages would have pretty poor teachers with limited experience, and cities, there could be great teachers. So we're trying to connect them up so that the best teacher can teach a class of 800 using Clicker as an interactive mechanism. And also AI can go in and replace all those homework and tests. And that's already beginning to be put in place.
How would AI replace the homework? I don't understand.
The AI would assign potentially different homework to each student based on their...
It would know which student is having problems in what areas.
Yeah, and then it would grade them automatically. So AI can already grade homeworks for not only multiple choice, but also fill in the blank, chemical equation, math proofs, and even even English and Chinese essays.
So this starts to get into the crux of the matter of AI, which is obviously AI is this huge boon to society. In many ways, it helps people. It increases corporate profits, which in turn help people further. But there's kind of a dark side to it. So if we're starting to replace the people who are delivering the food by auto-driving cars, if we're starting to replace the teachers, the artists, the workers who shelve factories, so everybody from blue-collar to white-collar, you know, the bank lending officers and so on, the fear is billions of jobs will be lost around the world. And you discuss all the options, like, should there be a universal basic income? Should there be a basic income that is paid to people who volunteer for services that might improve society? You come up with a lot of interesting solutions, but I want to first ask about the foundation of this. When ATMs developed in the U.S., you know, it seemed to replace the bank teller. You still need to get bigger. You can't have the same profits every year. You need to get bigger and bigger every year. So does that solve the problem at all, just this need for more profits, or do we still have the problem?
Oh, well, you're talking about, you know, Schumpeter's theory of creative destruction, of course, and that's certainly capitalism with larger volume could create more jobs. But I think the issue is in this particular case, in the case of AI, we're largely replacing the routine work so that we're not transforming them into more work. In the Industrial Revolution, when artisans who made cars were turned into assembly line, more jobs were created. There were lower level jobs, lower paying jobs, but there were tens or hundreds of times more of them. So unemployment was not an issue. I think in the bank's case, the banks were made more profitable with ATMs, but I think they actually hired transitioned a lot of the tellers into customer service, sales, and upselling. So I think that is workable, perhaps for some industries. But I think going forward, we're going to be talking about some bank is going to come out that has no tellers and no branches. We're already seeing that. There will be convenience stores with no clerks. There will be restaurants with no cooks and waiters. And those who choose to go for the lowest cost will win probably a large part of the business. Because after all, when we go to banks, convenience stores, and fast food places, we're not looking to socialize with the waiters, waitresses, and cooks, and clerks, and tellers. So the human component is not so important. Therefore, I do think many of the companies will choose to go fully automated so as to minimize cost. And then when users start to see, oh, if I go to this branchless bank, I get 1% more in interest rate. If I go to this humanless convenience store, everything's 20% off. If I go to this automated fast food, the food is half the price. Then enough people will go there so that what grows is the fully automated or mostly automated processes.
Right, because like take McDonald's as an example. You know, this huge, it's the largest restaurant chain in the world. It's also this huge ecosystem where high school students make enough money to pay for their basic needs. And you're saying that potentially in the future, that might not happen because it's not like there's going to be your McDonald's concierge who says, hey, are you happy with your food today? Or here's, why don't we recommend the quarter pounder instead of the Big Mac? Humans are just not going to want that social interaction in those cases.
That's right. I think, you know, Starbucks might or might not be okay. Michelin restaurants will be in great shape because there will be a lot of people. There will also be a larger number of ultra-rich people because wealth inequality increases. So there will be high-end restaurants, services, travel agencies that offer phenomenal concierge services. But that's a smaller number of jobs compared to the large number that would be automated.
And when you have this level of wealth inequality, it's hard to look at it for an example in history where there's this kind of inequality where something bad didn't happen to stop the inequality. I mean, China is a great example in the 60s where the inequality, you know, through violence was largely eliminated, but, you know, now the inequality is rising again. And you bring up some solutions, so let's talk about that. Universal basic income, is that a realistic thing, or will people have incentive to not work so they can qualify for universal basic income?
I think universal basic income alone will not work because it is, first of all, it's incredibly expensive. It's given to everybody. That's too wasteful. But most importantly, it is a way to give people, fix the income loss problem, but it doesn't solve the loss of meaning problem. Because many people, including most of the people who work routine jobs, basically associate their work as the meaning of their lives. So that when the work is gone, even if there is so-called UBI or welfare money for them to basically survive and live and eat and be safe, that is not what they want. People, I think, live for meaning, and increasing in the last few hundred years, especially through the Industrial Revolution, most people believe work hard and earn a good living and provide for the family as their primary reason for living. And when that's taken away, I think people will likely fall into depression substance abuse or even suicide. There are a lot of studies that shows people unemployed for 6 to 12 months or longer have a much higher tendency for substance abuse, depression, and suicide.
Even if they were on benefits or making small income from the government or whatever.
That's right. Well, most people in the U.S., 6 to 12 months of unemployment, they are covered. Mm. But I think that doesn't stop the depression or unhappiness. People really want something to do so that they feel, you know, it's the Maslow hierarchy, right? When the basic needs are met, people want to be respected and want to feel there's some degree of self-actualization.
And it's funny because with AI, it's almost like we need an AI Maslow's, you know, pyramid of needs, because all our needs, even intellectual, might be satisfied, but then it leaves us with nothing left to do. So you take UBI and you go further into some innovative solutions, like you suggest maybe a UBI that's tied with volunteer efforts.
Right.
How does a government afford that? How do people afford that?
I think it can be done incrementally. For example, today there are 1 million positions in elderly care that's open and available, but people don't apply for it. It's a mismatch. It's not as though the jobs are available, but they're not paying enough. That's basically the issue. People don't want the job because it pays too little. So if the government wants to have an investment or an incentive, but not overdo it by UBI or universally giving money for volunteerism, one interesting first step is to, can there be enough subsidy or tax deduction for people who take on the specific job of elderly care?
I wonder if that could be more entrepreneurial than government funded, so that there becomes, for instance, hiring agencies that develop, that focus on elderly care, or hiring agencies that develop into industries that aren't replaced completely by AI. And so maybe there still becomes innovation in industries that happen as a byproduct of AI solving all of our other problems.
Sure. I think corporate responsibility is probably a lot easier to achieve than having massive spending by the government. Companies like Amazon are putting in place training. Jeff Bezos was talking about training to become nurses. And I'm pretty sure he's thinking about the warehouse workers who over time will be replaced by AI and robotics.
And you make the interesting, somewhat cynical but it's also worth asking. Of course, companies are interested in providing this retraining because they don't want something bad to happen if there's massive inequality. So there's both sides of this. We want to do good, but also we're afraid of the bad.
Yes, yes. I think, well, Amazon is a great example. It's the first $1 trillion company. They are a beneficiary of AI and robotics, and they have all these warehouse workers who will be out of a job if they're not trained. It will leave the Amazon brand tainted. And also, I think every company should increasingly learn to become good citizens of the society so that their responsibilities don't stop with their shareholders and employees and customers.
And I wonder if the shareholders will reward them for that, because essentially you have to train the shareholders to reward them for that so that there's incentive for them to do this. There has to be incentives always.
Well, that's why Amazon is a good example, because Jeff has consistently done pretty courageous things against the shareholders' preference and proved to be right.
You know, I also want to touch on, you know, you mentioned AI and medical care, and you experienced this firsthand several years ago. You mentioned in the book, you came down with stage 4 lymphoma. And just to summarize your story, you had worked so hard for so many decades, and you were so highly respected in China. You were called Teacher Kaifu. You had 50 million social media followers, but you realized that when you were confronted with your own mortality, that, you know, having an impact, maybe you needed to focus a little bit more on the people closest to you, the people you loved. Side by side with that, you also did your own research and realized it's not all about stage 1, 2, 3, 4. There are maybe thousands of factors involved in medical diagnosis, and you did your research and realized it wasn't as bad as you might have thought. And thankfully, you're sitting here today with us. You're fully cured and a changed person as a result. What do you feel changed most with you when you were confronted with your own mortality? We're similar in age, so I'm always interested.
Yeah. Well, I know you're not a workaholic anymore, right?
It's true. I'm not.
You
used
to be.
Except for these podcasts. Yes.
That's right. It's wonderful. I think your lifestyle is the lifestyle we admire and should increasingly move towards. I think people, you know, I think there is unbelievable attraction and addiction to hard work, because hard work comes out with rewards.
And meaning, as you mentioned earlier.
And meaning, yes. Rewards in terms of financial fame, sense of accomplishment and actualization. This can become addictive. And that's what I fell into. And I think the societal values rewards that. People admire you if you work hard, or and certainly rewards you when you're successful. But when I was faced with the possibility that I had only months to live, it suddenly realized to me none of this really meant anything. That the only things that were meaningful to me was spending time with the people I loved and doing the things that I love. And then I realized how foolishly that I had lived, and I vowed to change my ways if I could get better. And I did. So I'm now really changing my own priorities. So I would put my family's priorities first. When they needed me, when they want to take a vacation, I just don't work. Fortunately, I'm a venture capitalist. My days are not required to be, 5 days a week or whatever. I can take more time off as they need it. Of course, they're still aware that I love my job too. So their requests are reasonable. So I now work maybe 20% less, but that's enough to just in time to spend the time with the family when they want and need it. And when I do spend time with them, I wholeheartedly spend time with them. I don't take my phone and my computer and open it up. And it was that awakening and epiphany that when I saw AI might take a lot of routine jobs away, I think actually for the very long term, it's good for humanity, because we continue to fall into this trap of downward spiral of continuing to be addicted to work and seemingly prove that we're worth something. But in fact, when we pass on and die, we won't be remembered. So it's really a matter of giving back to the people who love you. So that, and also that, I think for the AI that takes the jobs away, well, what jobs could be created? Because of my own experience, I would think we have to create jobs around compassion and love. Not just voluntary jobs, but jobs that have an economic value, but maybe just not enough. Jobs that are including teachers and nurses and nannies, and jobs that include psychiatrists and elderly companion, elderly caretaker. I think those jobs can absorb a lot of the people who may lose their jobs due to AI displacement. And these are compassionate jobs, are not only large enough in quantity, they don't require a whole lot of training, a lifelong training. And also, I think at the end of the day, I got to think someone who took care of two elderly people have got to feel better at the end of the day than someone who just repetitively did the same thing on the assembly line.
And you know, I mean, I think that's so valuable. Like what you went through, how you then analyzed your own illness, which of course, by the way, it seems to have informed some of your thinking on AI, that every situation is different. Maybe when we're educated to be a doctor, we learn stage one, stage two, stage three, stage four, sort of fitting everybody into the same bucket. But the reality is every type of cancer is different. Every type of illness is different. Every human's different. And AI with the massive amounts of data can more quickly, accurately diagnose, recommend cures, potentially process those cures in you and so on. But then there's the flip side where, okay, as you mentioned, many jobs will be displaced because AI is going to infiltrate every area of our life. And we have to learn how to find meaning in perhaps compassion and love and so on. and find the jobs for that. It could be the jobs you mentioned, could be entertainment. I mean, I imagine the entertainment industry, while it's massively changing, won't be displaced. You know, you still need story writers and so on. One thing, you've experienced so much in the history of innovation and Silicon Valley and the growth of technology in China. You're really, you've had your legs in both kind of centers of technology that have risen up, and you've been in the center, just having been at Apple, Microsoft, Google, and all the places in China. Can I ask you just a few names and what you think of them in a sentence or two?
Sure.
Bill Gates, you were running Microsoft China, or you were heavily involved in their Chinese strategy. You worked there for a while. What do you think of Bill Gates?
Well, I'm incredibly impressed with his big heart and how he transformed himself from a very successful business person into a very responsible philanthropist who actually uses his IQ to understand how he could put his billions at work to make humanity better.
Steve Jobs.
Well, I'm just blown away by his brilliance and his combination of artistic as well as technical skills to integrate and build things that people don't know what they need. I mean, we're used to thinking about understanding users and building what they want. Steve is one of the very few people who could build something that you don't know that you want, but once you see it, you really want it.
How do you think he was able to do that?
I think he must have a gift, and his combination of incredible communications skills and access to technology at the right place, right time, connecting all the dots, and maybe the time that he spent on the high mountains in India gave him some revelation. No idea.
Larry Page and Sergey Brin.
I think Larry and Sergey are amazing technologists who basically created a miracle by building, I think, an amazing high IQ, small team culture, and with very consistent value throughout the company. And I think it's also trying to do something big with Alphabet. We'll see if that works in turning a one product company into a conglomerate and essentially using technology and AI to change the world.
I mean, certainly with their acquisition of DeepMind, plus the enormous, right now they probably have more data than just about any other company in the world, probably even including at this moment Chinese companies. Do you think they have a chance to be the ultimate winner in the AI race?
I think if there is one company that could be the winner out of the AI race, it would be them. Although I don't think it'll be one company, but I do think they're ahead of everyone else.
And Amazon as well, because they know so much about our purchasing behavior.
Amazon doesn't have the AI depth that Google has, but I think Amazon has that willingness to do whatever it takes to win and thinking ahead in terms of business strategy. So it has kind of the best of both the Chinese and U.S. worlds. And I think it's that business genius that I admire.
Yeah, because if you look at how you describe Chinese companies, maybe Amazon's the closest cousin in that, in their online to offline efforts. They do have some AI in the sense that they want people to shop in their stores without any clerks. They kind of pioneered the recommendation engines.
Right.
So I guess to close off, what is the next step in AI? Because I sort of feel like when you and I spoke about AI in 1989 or 1991, you know, I sort of see what's happened is since then, and here we are in 2018, computers have gotten a lot faster. There's a lot more data. There's more people who are AI engineers, but that would have happened naturally. But really the thing that's changed AI, I feel, is more data, faster computers. What's the next real innovation in AI, if there is going to be one?
Well, I think I actually think the biggest thing in the next 10 to 15 years is penetration into every industry. I think sometimes we just forget how much things have changed. When you and I first met, I had 100 megabytes of speech data. Now people have 100 T. That's, you know, a million times more data. And the power that has to help every imaginable business, I think, is the biggest deal ahead of us. If I had to pick one or two big breakthroughs, I think one would be an autonomous vehicle truly working without any human intervention. That's probably in the 10-year kind of horizon, technically. Might take longer due to other reasons. Another is basically use DNA sequencing combined with targeted, personalized AI medicine and cure that might cure cancer or other types of health issues. And then lastly is maybe a little controversial, something that can remember everything in my life, and then I can intelligently index into any part. So it truly augments our memory, not as an implant, but just as a device that remembers.
So Kai-Fu Lee, thank you so much for coming on my podcast. The book is, or your most recent book is AI Superpowers, China, Silicon Valley, and the New World Order. And I didn't think the China part would influence me that much, but it actually inspired me as an entrepreneur. Like, it's just, it was so fascinating to see entrepreneurship from your view and how it's taking place now in China, which is relatively new to it. It was just fascinating. But also your view on AI, which I have valued for 30 years, and then your stories of your own illness and what you got through that, I think is so important for people to read. I think this is an incredibly valuable book to understand business, the future, what's happening, and how we personally can react to it. And thanks once again also for saying no to me when I wanted you to be my PhD thesis advisor and work on an AI Go program, because we didn't realize then it would take another 26 years to happen.
Yeah.
So thanks once again.
Hey, you're welcome. Great to be on the show. Thanks, James.
Thanks. That was great. Thank you so much.
You seek the key, but first you must learn the ways of precision, craft, and performance with Acura's all-electric ZDX. With a premium Bang & Olufsen sound system, up to a 313-mile range and a Type S variant with an estimated 500 horsepower, the ZDX is their most powerful SUV yet. Unlock the energy when you visit Acura.com to order yours today.